Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see what's on the menu for today's Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Catch 35, the perfect menu for your next business lunch. It's 12:07. John Williams here. So, yeah, maybe people are just buying the dip. You'd like to read a little more into what's happened on the markets the last couple days. We'll keep an eye on that in this hour. We'll also talk about jobs and where they are going. I met somebody the other night who at an event said, I am desperate for people to work, and it's really an interesting job. So he's going to join us in the next half hour. It's all coming up. Tom Gimble, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Tom. I hope you're well.
I am well, John. I was afraid you were going to go, speaking of being off base, let's have Tom Gimble. I was a little nervous.
Well, I was thinking that. I would just never say that.
I appreciate it.
So you sent us this 42-page document about the Bureau of Labor Statistics job openings and labor turnover sheet. Why is this on your radar, sir?
Well, when you have labor turnover and job openings, it really shows what the supply and demand is and where we're at. So the number of job openings has decreased to just over 10 million, and that's a decrease from a million jobs over the previous month. Hires were little changed at 6.3 million, right? And so when you've got this situation, it shows that while the number of jobs are still outpacing potential people who want jobs, it has slowed down a little bit, which kind of mirrors where the economy's at right now.
But, I mean, the bottom line is we still have fewer hires per job openings, that there are still jobs out there.
Correct. And exactly. The economy, you know, you've heard me say this, you know, more than enough times, but I think that we've got a situation where people want there to be a bad economy for God knows what reason, and it's still healthy. We're still adding jobs. We'll see next Friday that we'll have added, my guess is we'll have added jobs for September again for another consecutive month. We see that unemployment is still going to be under 4%. I don't see that rising over 4%. And we'll see that wages are probably, even if not a cent or two higher. So I think that the economy is still in a really good place right now.
What do you think of this, Tom? I got a text message or an email from a listener the other day. He was about 62 years old. He was an HR professional, certified, good background, good track record, lost his job during the pandemic. He's interviewed or applied for 22 different positions. He said his salary requirements are modest. He's only gotten 4 callbacks, and he hasn't been able to land a job in his chosen field. And we were talking about ageism because he's over 60. Is there some of that out there, do you think?
Yeah, I think that there's ageism on both sides of the spectrum. And I think that there are jobs that people don't want to trust young kids with, and that there are jobs that people who are probably closer to retirement than they are the middle of their career, that a lot of companies want people who can be with the company for 10 years, 8, 10, 12 years. And so you do have that. I'm not here to say it's good, bad, or otherwise. We should hire people who are qualified for the job. However, at the same time, if you have a news radio station and you hire somebody who only has done rock DJ music stations and they don't want to do news, you're trying to put a round peg in a square hole. And so I think if you've got a high-growth company that's hiring hundreds if not thousands of people, and you've got an HR manager who's never been in that environment and was more of a staid manufacturing business, mm-hmm. that maybe that person isn't right for it. And I've been doing this for over 25 years, John. I've rarely had a job seeker say, I'm not right for a role.
Yeah. Well, this guy sure made it sound like he was. And if you're 62, and he said, by the way, he looks 53, but say you're 62, it's reasonable, right, that you would work until, say, Social Security, until you have to take Social Security. He could be in that job for 6 more years.
I would say that the right role for people like that, especially in this economy, is contract work, temp work. And so there's a ton of white-collar jobs in HR and accounting and marketing and in so many different jobs that you can go out and a lot of times make more money than you would in a salaried position. And it's a great bridge for people that can't find a job.
What last thing did you pull out of this Bureau of Labor Stats? What last thing did you pull out of there that you think is of interest to the rest of us?
I think the main thing to look at for people is if you're looking for a reason not to enter the job market, you're sorely mistaken. Is that even when certain things decline, it doesn't mean that it's not healthy. Nothing can be in a lower left to upper right growth for forever. But it doesn't mean that it's still not stronger than it has been. And if we look year over year and we look where it was in 2018 or 2019, the employment market is really in a strong place. And if you want a job and you're not getting one, maybe you're shooting too high for what your skill set is, but the opportunities are out there.
Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Thank you, Tom.
Stay healthy, John Williams.
Got some texts about our conversation with Tom here. I'll read a few of these after the news. And Philip Weiss also will join us from SciFarth at Work. He's always got interesting strategies for employees and employers. It's 1220 on WGN Radio. Philip Weiss joins us, the president of SciFarth at Work. Philip's always got interesting stories, anecdotes, and observations. But get a load of this, what we can learn from the asteroid deflection. Philip, are you going to make that a business parable for us somehow?
Oh, well, I am, and I can't take full credit for the parable. It's really instructive, though, because we've been hearing it in the last week from a number of different executives and business owners who are sort of transfixed by this the successful NASA impact of the asteroid about a week ago. And what they've sort of the lesson they've taken and they've shared from it is based on the scientific premise that if you nudge or prod a celestial object just a bit, yeah, but early enough in time, the idea is it would miss Earth if it was heading our way. And they're looking at that event. They're fascinated by the science, but they're also looking at their own business and saying, you know what? When we attempt to affect wholesale change in the moment, it rarely works. But if we look back and we prodded an employee, nudged them, nudged the team to do one thing a little bit differently, that in the same way as hitting the asteroid, incrementally over time can have a huge positive impact. So we've got about a half dozen companies that are sharing the lessons of the NASA mission with their own employees.
Give me an example. So you're saying, right, that if I compliment or affirm an employee somehow, that that'll pay dividends for a while, right?
That's right. And your example is really a good one because we have seen companies who've gone wholesale into an initiative to make sure that there's all kinds of praise and recognition. And they found that if it was too much of a large shift in how people manage, it was new to them, and it was too much of an ask, it never worked. Instead, if companies, for example, say, look it, let's find one opportunity a week when an employee contributed in a new way, in a meaningful way, compliment that contribution, you can really create what we call a praise habit that takes over the workplace. And at one Chicago marketing company, whose executives were talking about the NASA mission, they actually invoked this very scenario. And they said, you know, we did experience this because we just asked people to praise once a week. And that praise habit really caught on. And a few years later, we had 60-65% of our employees in surveys saying, my manager appreciates me more than they did before. Mm-hmm. So they're taking that and they're saying, where else can we apply this notion of incremental positive prods, letting them take hold and letting them play out over time?
Well, I suppose you ought to do that because that's just how you should treat people, but I wonder how you gauge the efficacy of that, the productivity of that. Is this necessarily going to make these people better employees or more productive at their jobs?
Yeah, well, that's really where the rubber meets the road because it's an easy answer when you have some metrics, such as these employee surveys or greater productivity because you see the work that's getting done or the errors that are decreasing. And we've seen all of that when something is done in this sort of methodical but reasonable way, because the person who's doing the prodding, they got to feel like it's time efficient. The person that's being prodded in this one way every so often has got to feel like it's achievable. But it can apply to not just employees, John. It can apply to money, to profits, to revenues. We have a West Coast company, a seafood chain, where they decided a few years back, let's just encourage our wait staff to recommend an additional appetizer, their favorite personal appetizer, to larger parties, parties of five or more at the bigger tables. Over time, they saw a 5% increase in net revenue. So there was a metric they could tie that to. And they also then tell those employees, ask for some patron and diner feedback on what you recommended. And from that, they saw menu improvements. So the key here is, if it's a simple prod that you can build into your practice, it will build on itself. And you'll see the benefits, whether it's a metric, it's satisfaction, or it's other intangible benefits that you can witness in the workplace.
This power of small prods you're talking about, when you first introduced it, I thought you were going to say that you would prod people when they were doing poorly, that you would critique them in a constructive way, but you'd say, hey, Bob, you should be doing it this way. And, you know, don't blow up on Bob, but nudge him in a corrective way. Is that something you're talking about, or is it more just on the complimentary side?
Well, it's another really good question. And, John, it absolutely has value in the kind of performance feedback, constructive criticism department, in the sense that people should feel that what you ask them to do is achievable. It's not hitting it out of the park. And you got to make sure it's a positive interaction. The risk factor with these performance feedback discussions, when they're really missing the mark entirely, is you want to also be very consistent with everybody that you're talking to. So when we train people on performance feedback, we want to keep it positive, but we want to be clear and consistent. So there's more layers to what you have to do. It's not simply a creative attempt to get someone to do something, but you raise a bigger point as well. Sometimes it's something someone does not want to do. So when we consult with people who are trying to sell their business or they want to do a succession plan and they don't know where to start, we tell them, just let go of one small area of authority, one area of responsibility. See how people do with it, and you will see with the benefit of confidence and trust, more will be released. So when people don't want to do it, it's helpful. When they do want to engage in the practice, it's helpful as well.
Okay, we're out of time, but you know, one last just observation I'll make based on what you've told us today, Philip, is that that's not just good ways to run in a business, interact with employees. It's a good way to interact with your kids. You know, if you want them to clean up the room, don't blow up on them and then say, hey, you got to change completely. How can I nudge them into better behavior? How can I compliment their better behavior? I suppose that works with spouses and significant others, too. It's interpersonal communication you're talking about.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Everything we've taught every company of every size boils down to, it's about good interactions. Yeah. It's the same thing as educating a child or treating a significant other with basic respect and clarity. So these lessons have not changed through time immemorial.
Philip Weiss, President, Seyfarth at Work, SEYFARTH, Seyfarth at Work. Thanks, Philip.
Thanks for having me.
1238 WGN, Wintrust Business Lunch. All the major averages are now each above 5%, above their lows of the year. We're having a good day. Yesterday was a good day, too. By the way, a moment ago, we talked to Tom Gimble from LaSalle Network about the economy and jobs. And among the texts that came in, what about most of the new jobs being part-time these days when everybody touts all the new jobs out there? 773 said, my son has a double major from the University of Illinois. Still hasn't found a job. He's not being real picky. 765 said, it is still a strong economy and a very strong labor market. Tough to have a bad recession when the labor market is as strong as it is. For 125 years now, McHugh Construction has been building some of the most iconic buildings in Chicago. I'm thinking about Marina City. I'm thinking about the St. Regis, the Jeannie Gang building that's two doors down from where I'm standing right now. They're celebrating 125 years of putting stuff up in Chicago. Michael Maher is the president of McHugh Construction. Hey, Michael, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you today?
Great, John. Good afternoon, and it's great to be on your show. And we're both celebrating big anniversaries at WGN at 100,
yeah,
and McHugh at 125.
Yeah, shoot. Let's see, 125. You guys are older than us by 25 years. Imagine
we don't look it.
You know, as much as we've taken a step back in time to say, here's what radio was like then and now. Imagine the construction practices and mechanics then to now. My, how the world must have changed for you guys.
Absolutely. We have some pictures in the office going back to job sites back in 1921, 23, and it's really fascinating to see how things have changed in technology and the men and women who build these buildings.
And yet, you know, as a person who's worked in an old building, the Tribune Tower, or for that matter, who has a really, really old house, I sometimes marvel at the durability of structures that are over 100 years old, too.
Well, that's an ode to our great labor force in Chicago. We have fantastic men and women that are building these buildings, and it's safe, productive, and really high-quality work. And it truly is unique. We've worked in other parts of the country. We are working in other parts of the country, but our home base is Chicago. The majority of our work is here in Chicago.
Can you talk about your work? Talk about your work on the St. Regis then.
Sure. St. Regis was a great project. It's a hotel and condos, and that's super luxury building. And it was a really unique project designed by Jeannie Gang. This was our second major project with Jeannie Gang. Aqua, just around the corner, was the first one. Mm-hmm. And it's a gorgeous, St. Regis is a gorgeous facility that just is doing really well with sales. I think last week there was a big announcement. It had one of the largest sale of any unit in Illinois in 2022, and that was at $20.6 million for a condo that we're particularly very proud to build.
Yeah, so do you build in the units then too? You all, if you put the building up, do people hire separate contractors to build the units themselves, or is that all you also?
No, that's a great question. On St. Regis, there were very few that were built out otherwise. Otherwise, we did all the build-outs of the units, and they're super high-end, just amazing finishes, and there's some amazing views up there too.
Well, didn't you put a swimming pool in one of those private residences up there?
We did. We did, and that's on about the 71st floor, and it turns out to be, at least from my readings, our research, I think it's the tallest privately owned swimming pool in the United States, and it's really a remarkable view up there. It's on about, like I said, 71, and it has a north, south, and east view.
But is that an indoor pool, or is that on the roof?
Well, it's on the roof, and if you look, it's hard to do this over the radio, but if you look at that beautiful building, mm-hmm. there's a setback.
Yep.
The second setback yep. is that roof is where that pool would be.
So that's somebody's private residence there. That's not communal.
Correct. The
wow.
first setback is communal. That's the amenity floor. That's at the 47th floor, and that's a gorgeous, gorgeous floor, and that's for all the residents to share, and there's an outdoor pool as well as some grills and party rooms and wine rooms, and it's really a beautiful building.
The St. Regis is notable for a lot of reasons, the beautiful architecture and style of it, that it's on the lake, and I believe the idea was that the waviness of the building mirrors the waviness of the water and the shoreline itself. And it also has near the top that breezeway of a floor where it's not units, but that's to reduce the sway of the building. Is that right?
Yes, sir. That's correct. That's we call it the blow-through floor, and that is provided more of a creature comfort. We also have some water ballast up in the building, which help control sway too. So when you get that tall and thin, you have to control that sway. And there's a lot of buildings. Many of the buildings we've done in Chicago have that as well. It's not unusual. Not the blow-through floor. That is unusual.
So how's business, and what are you guys building these days?
Just yesterday, John, we had a groundbreaking for a project called the Cassidy, which is for habitat development. It's on Canal Street, and it's a beautiful. We are literally doing caissons. We just finished caissons yesterday. It's a 34-story, 343 apartments, and that's pretty neat. The Habitat's a long-standing Chicago company, and we actually go back generations of doing work with them, not decades, but generations. They're celebrating their 50th year of business in Chicago.
What about?
And we
go ahead. Keep going.
Go ahead.
No.
The other one we were recently, two others that we just started, is a really beautiful condo development in the Fulton Market District called the Embry, and that's on May Street, and that's 15 stories, and it's about 58 condos, and that's going to be very high end condo project. And then we just also started on a great apartment project called 225 Elizabeth for Sterling Bay, and that's over in Fulton Market District, and that's going to be a 28-story, 350 apartments, finished in mid 24 is when that'll be finished.
So is business good then? Is the is it booming? Is it mid-level? Is it still catching up? How is your industry doing in this city anyway?
There's room for improvement. It's doing well. The trades here are very busy. There's also a ton of road work, as you know, going on from 294 and everywhere. So the trades are really quite busy. But the building construction, there's a lot in the pipeline, but with rates going up and the headwinds on property taxes, we're hopeful some of those projects will still break through. We have a lot in our drawing room, a lot in our plan table that we'd like to see bust out and become real projects.
That is an interesting half sentence there. The headwinds include property taxes. So is somebody like you, like we all champion buildings when they're up and hope that they fill, but they're not going to get built if in anticipation of higher property taxes, a realtor says, I don't think I can sell the units. Is that a consideration when you guys are drawing or building things?
It is for our clients, and what the clients are looking for, our developers are looking for, is certainty in taxes and not a lot of variance.
Yeah.
And that's what we're hoping is going to happen. We're going to have more certainty. If we have certainty, then I think we can build.
One last thing. Just give me a short answer to what's Flyover in Chicago that you're working on.
Oh, Flyover in Chicago is a really cool immersive experience. There's some flyovers in some other cities currently right now, but it's going to be an immersive flight ride. It's sort of like an ultimate flying ride, and they're doing a really unique state-of-the-art moving platform that has some certain amount of degrees of multi-sensory special effects, and it's going to be an immersive experience that's going to really bring out the best in Chicago, because I think they're going to do a special film. It's kind of like the old big Omni theaters, it's going to be like that, but I think it's to a level that hasn't been reached before. There's a flyover in a few other cities, and they're just going over really, really well. And Navy Pier has been a great client. There's been a lot of great renovation work that's happened there. So this is just a continuation of Navy Pier's improvements.
A flying ride coming to Navy Pier, and in good hands, it sounds like, McHugh Construction. Michael, congratulations to you all. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you so much for the recognition. Our men and women of McHugh really appreciate it.
It's 12:47 on WGN. More business news from Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says Illinois' economy passed $1 trillion in annualized gross domestic product in 2022. The Illinois Economic Policy Institute and the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign used federal data for the report that also shows Illinois pacing above other Midwestern states, thanks to a boost provided by Chicago. Illinois is the fifth state to top $1 trillion in annualized GDP. California, Texas, New York, and Florida are the others. Cranes reports Illinois' second quarter 2022 GDP was 20% higher than Ohio, the next closest Midwest state, and more than a double that of Indiana. The report suggests downstate is holding back Illinois' overall growth. The owner of Weiss Memorial Hospital in Chicago and West Suburban Medical Center in Oak Park has filed for bankruptcy protection. Pipeline Health Systems also operates Heights hospitals in Dallas and Los Angeles. The bankruptcy filing comes just 4 months after Illinois regulators approved a deal to sell West Suburban and Weiss to Resilience Healthcare. The $92 million deal is reportedly still on the table, but a closing date hasn't been set. Pipeline could look for another buyer if that deal falls through. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, and we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Oh, what a day we have on our food calendar. It is National Cinnamon Bun Day. It's National Taco Day. It's National Vodka Day, too. All products of agriculture, I should point out. And about a week ago, I got an announcement from the State Department of Ag that a deal was done to sell $2.6 billion worth of Illinois soybeans and corn to Taiwan over the next 2 years. And it got me wondering, how does it get there and how long does it take? Here to help is
Colin Waters, and I'm the Director of Exports and Logistics at Illinois Corn.
Okay, well, let's begin at harvest in central Illinois.
After the combine, it'll move to storage, whether on farm or at the elevator. And then it'll make its way to a larger terminal. So potentially, you know, in Illinois, there's a lot of movement on the river system.
And if all goes well, barges loaded on the upper Illinois River would float all the way down to New Orleans, where the grain would be loaded onto big ships. And I mean big ships.
A Panamax vessel would be like 760 rail cars or like 40-some barges it would take to fill a Panamax.
The Ag Department says the $2.6 billion deal amounts to 59 million bushels of corn, and that would take 21 of those big Panamax ships, and about 100 million bushels of soybeans, and that would take about 40 of the Panamax ships. The first job, though, is to get the corn and beans to New Orleans, and Colin Waters says if it all goes well, it takes about 2 weeks for the barges to reach NOLA. But right now, the water level in the Mississippi is so low, barge traffic is limited, and the ones that can get through carry smaller loads, and the cost of shipping by barge has skyrocketed. There is another option, though.
Train cars, grain cars, that'll make their way out to the Pacific Northwest.
But there are nature and man-made problems there, too. So, back to the river system, if all things are working, he says it would take about 45 days for the corn and beans to get from the upper Illinois River to Taiwan. That's if everything's working, and right now, they're not. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
I was at Union Station the other day talking to a guy named James Laughlin. He's the CEO of Midwest Tankerman, Inc. We were at a gala for Pastor Corey Brooks and Project Hood. And as he and I were chatting, he said, well, here's what I do, and we need people to help do it. He's looking for employees. James, welcome to the show. Tell us what your business is. What are you in the business of doing?
Hello, John, and thank you for having me on the call and on your show. Before I get started, I do have to say, I told my mom I was going to be on your radio show, and she actually did one of those, almost like a little screech that, you know, musicians get when they step up on stage. So it's needless to say that my mother is a big fan, and she's very excited for me to be on today.
Oh, hooray.
But what essentially what we do is our employees, they load and unload barges that are filled with liquid hazardous material. So in a very brief example, there's a ExxonMobil refinery in Joliet, Illinois, and they have to take in a cargo that's called naphtha in order to make the gasoline and diesel fuel that they sell all around the Chicago area. Our employees will be responsible for unloading a barge that is filled with naphtha, and it goes inside the Exxon refinery, and they manufacture it from there.
So it's by barge that we're talking about, so this is water traffic?
Yes, yes. We work strictly on barges. We're starting to do some work inside facilities and inside various plants, but the majority of our work is all done on barges.
Midwest Tankerman, so I get it. So are you working at the refineries around the Chicagoland area that are accessed by river then?
Yes, yes. We work at over 80 facilities in the Chicago area. Hmm. You know, as you may be aware of, the shipping industry and the river industry is a It's an industry that goes back many, many years. It's been around for a long time. It's going to continue to be around for a long time. And it's often overlooked by our population and kind of one of those things that's just forgotten about is how crucial it is to our supply chain.
Yeah, boy, we always take those things for granted. You're based out of Lockport, so you need men and women to operate these boats. Is that what you're looking for?
Close, but not quite. So our employees do not ride on the actual boats. The barge will arrive at its location. So using the Exxon example, a barge arrives at Exxon and our employees will drive from their house. They will drive through the Exxon facility down to the river, and they will take some hand tools and some fire extinguishers out on them with them out onto the barge and conduct their work. And we are looking to hire some employees that will work out in the field, so both loading and unloading barges. And we also are looking to hire additional people to our management team as well, too.
How do these jobs pay?
You know, they pay very well. One of the great things about our industry is you don't have to have a college degree. You don't have to know the right people. It really, for thousands of years, it's been built off of people who have a good work ethic and a good attitude. If you're wanting to work some overtime, you can make over $100,000 as a shore tankerman. But that's obviously as you've kind of had some experience and grown in your pay and are also, again, willing to work some overtime. But this is still the land of opportunity, and usually those that are willing to work can do well for themselves.
Okay, let's do this. James Laughlin is the chief executive officer at that Midwest Tankermen Inc. company based out of Lockport. I'm going to catch up with you again, but what's the number we should give, or what's the website you want people to go to, James?
Sure. Our website is MidwestTankerMen.com, and that's Tankermen, M-E-N, at the end there. And our office number is 815-834-1414.
Okay. I met this guy the other night. I like the cut of his jib. This sounds like hard work, but if you want to do hard work and make some money, who doesn't these days, then why don't you visit MidwestTankerMen.com. Let you and I catch up in a couple of weeks and see how things are going, James.
That sounds great. I look forward to it. Thank you, John.